Last case in our calendar is 06-2187, Francis Howe Green, Township Law Director versus Jerry R. Porter. Mr. Singleton.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, opposing counsel, Mr. Johnson Grove. May it please the court. David Singleton, Ohio Justice and Policy Center for Gary R. Porter, Jr. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Mr. Porter asserts two very narrow reasons, why Ohio's sex offender residency statute cannot apply to him. First, the legislature did not clearly express its intent to apply the statute retroactively to someone who purchased their home and therefore established their residence before the law went into effect. And second, even if the legislature did express its intent to do so, this statute cannot apply to Mr. Porter because it impairs his vested rights, namely his fundamental right to live in his home. I'd like to take up the statutory interpretation question first. Revised Code 1.48 says that statutes in Ohio must be presumed to be prospective only unless expressly made retroactive. And this court has reaffirmed that principle time and time again, most recently in the Concilio case. And what this court said in Concilio is that the statute must proclaim its retroactivity itself. Inferences aren't enough. The language must be clear.
You're right about that statement of law, but are there situations where a statute, even though General Assembly hasn't given us those sort of magic words, where we can tell from the words of the statute that the General Assembly intended for it to be retroactive?
Yes, but that's not this case. We're talking about 8 words that matter here in terms of what the legislature intended. And those words are, no sex offender, and here are the important words, shall establish a residence or occupy residential premises, and then the statute continues, within 1,000 feet of residential premises. Let's take the first part of that, shall establish. Shall establish is clearly future focused. Shall establish means to bring into being that which does not already exist. The intent there, we suggest, is crystal clear that the legislature was talking about prohibiting sex offenders from establishing new residences after the statute went into effect.
Well, but the statute begins with, this is Revised Code 2950.031, right? Is that what we're talking
about? That's correct.
Yeah. What starts is, no person who has been convicted of, is convicted of, has pleaded guilty to, or pleads, as you know, has been convicted of. That's the language that seems to indicate that it refers to the past.
That language does refer to people who have been convicted in the past. But that's not the only question here. The question is, did the legislature intend it to apply to individuals who had established residences before and were occupying residential premises before? And we suggest to you that language is unclear. It's ambiguous. So the shall establish part is clearly aimed at preventing sex offenders from establishing new residences. And let's talk about the second part of it, shall occupy. And I think you have to read the shall to go in front of the occupy also. Occupy has several meanings. Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition, defines it as the very first definition you see is to take or enter into possession of. That's the first definition. The second definition is to hold possession. Now, what did the legislature mean here? Did it mean the first definition or the second definition of occupy? If you read it as the legislature was prohibiting sex offenders from taking possession, entering possession after the effective date, well, the intent there is not to apply it retroactively. It's to apply it going forward to sex offenders who enter new resident, who take up occupation after the law goes into effect. It is certainly the case that the government could argue, and it might mean that the legislature meant to prohibit continuing occupation, but because you have a word that is ambiguous, that has several meanings, we don't know what the legislature intended.
I want to follow up with that, and in line with what the chief has pointed out, the statute talks about those who, an individual who has been convicted.
That's correct.
And if you talk about an individual who has been convicted, then there are two prohibitions. One is he shall not establish a residence, which could be a future situation.
Right.
And an individual who has been convicted, he shall neither establish a residence or occupy a residence. And doesn't that indicate that the legislature has already suggested its intent with respect to the retroactive application?
It's not as clear as it needs to be or should be, because occupy could just be referring to taking possession, and that's future oriented. If the definition of occupy, if one definition is to take or enter into possession of, and you're saying you shall not do that, that is referring to something in the future. And the fact that it might also be the case that the legislature may have intended.
Well, some could argue that Mr. Porter occupies a residence.
That's
at least a fair interpretation in this instance?
It's a fair interpretation, but what you need.
Well, doesn't the statute then say an individual who has been convicted should not be one to occupy a residence?
It depends on what the legislature meant by occupy.
I guess that's what we have to figure out in this case,
And the legislature didn't do enough to help you figure that out in terms of whether they intended it to apply retroactively. In Concilio, this court cited to State X Rel Slaughter, where there was crystal clear language of legislative intent. Here, in that case, the statute read, the provisions of this act shall apply to all work relief employees who are injured, whether such injury or death occurs prior to the operative date of this act or subsequent thereto. If the legislature in this case were clearly expressing the intent to apply this statute to someone who purchased a home before the law went into effect, it could have read, regardless of the date of conviction or regardless of the date that property rights have accrued, no sex offender shall occupy or continue to occupy residential premises within 1,000 feet of a school. That would be an example of a clear, express intent to apply it retroactively. Here we're left with eight words that appear to be future focused. Occupy might mean that it's applying to someone who is continuing occupation, or it might also mean someone who takes possession after the effective date. If it's a might or a maybe situation, that does not cut it under this court's case law, Concilio. It doesn't cut it under Revised Code 1.48. And therefore, this court should hold that this statute can apply prospectively only and cannot apply to Mr. Porter. But even if you disagree with how we are interpreting what we suggest is an ambiguous statute, even if you say that or find that this statute has the requisite retroactive expression. This statute cannot apply to Mr. Porter because it impairs his vested substantive rights. We are not talking in this case about passing a law that says that homeowners have to connect to a sewer line in order to be able to reside in their homes. We are talking about one of the most fundamental rights known to man and womankind, the right to property. This court in Norwood versus Horney described the right of property as fundamental and original, as sacrosanct. And this court also said that the venerable bundle of rights associated with property must be trod upon lightly, no matter how great the weight of other forces are. And so we're talking about a fundamental right here.
Well, in this fundamental right, they took away an important stick out of the bundle of rights, and that is the right to live there. He can still own, but he can't live there.
His right to own that residence that he purchased in 1991 with his wife before this law was ever on the books.
It doesn't impair his ability to own it. It impairs his ability to live there.
And it has stripped from him the most important right to him, which is to live there. That's the right that matters.
So that's the biggest stick in the bundle.
That's the biggest stick in the bundle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe depending on why you buy a home, maybe that wouldn't be the biggest if it's Donald Trump, maybe it's not. Maybe he's buying it for other reasons to sell it on later and make a profit. But when Mr. Porter bought that home with his wife, he bought it as a residence. That stick of residence is the biggest and most important stick in his property rights bundle, yes. And what the government has done is it's taken that stick away, it has ousted him from his home, and it has clearly impaired his interest, no matter how you want to define impair. If you look in the dictionary, impair is to limit, to weaken, to make worse. it's taken this right away from him. And where the First District Court of Appeals erred was saying that you had to have total divestiture of this important of property rights in order for it to be impaired for constitutional purposes. There, nowhere in this court's jurisprudence is there support for a total divestiture rule when we're talking about the prohibition against retroactive laws in Section 28, Article 2 of our Constitution. In the OSAI case that we cited, that case that involved a punitive damages cap, limiting punitive damages to 3 times the amount of the compensatory damages, in that case, this court found that such a cap applied retroactively impaired a vested right. Now, we weren't talking about total divestiture of the right to get punitive damages in that case. We were just talking about limiting it.
Do you argue, or is it your position at all, that prospectively they can cannot prohibit purchasing property, or is it only because of the fact that they've already vested in this property?
It's because it's vested. We have no quarrel. We may argue in different forum about the policy. That's not before this court. We have no quarrel with the government applying this statute to Mr. Porter prospectively. And now the statute's gotten worse. It's now daycares and preschools in addition to schools.
Well, but
and we're not challenging.
If the right to own property is also the right to enjoy property, that doesn't.
Well,
how does your argument fit that?
I think, Your Honor, it's because his right to buy property in the future, it has not vested. That's the reason why. It's inchoate. It's an expectancy. Yeah, it's important. And believe me, I would love for Mr. Porter to be able to go and buy any property he wants to buy, but that's not this case. And we're not asking the court to hold that. What we're asking the court to hold is that when you have a man who's in his home and you order him out, that impairs his vested right. That's a very narrow issue. That's the only issue that this court has to decide in this case.
So, Mr. Singleton, you're stating that your argument here is a constitutional attack as applied to your client solely on the issue of retroactivity.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. This is not a facial challenge to the statute. We're not contending that the statute can't be applied as to other individuals who purchase homes and move to within 1,000 feet of a school. Yeah, the state can apply it. But if that person has established a right that's in their home, ownership interest, it can't be taken away retroactively. That's just bedrock principle, bedrock law in this state, because property rights are so important, and because we abhor, as a state, we abhor retroactive laws.
Would that apply to an individual who's leasing a property?
Which part of it?
If your client had been leasing a property, would you make the same position rather than own?
If he had leased the property, he would have a right in the lease, certainly. He would have a contract. And in fact, if he had been leasing a home at the time that the statute came into effect, the statute would have grandfathered him because he was a renter. Does this light mean that I'm done with my time, or?
That's a white light. That's 2 minutes. We have 2 minutes remaining.
Okay,
Does the fact that the 1,000 feet doesn't actually come into the home where he's living, as I understand it, that 1,000 feet only comes actually 17 feet onto his backyard?
That's correct.
What if he should divest himself of of course, he would have the opportunity to divest himself of 17 feet by, maybe if he has a spouse, put it in his spouse's name or something. Does that affect your argument in any way, the fact that he still could, under these facts, still live in this property?
Well, number one, that's not this case, but believe me, we've tried, and that's not something that we were able to make happen. Number two, that would still be divesting him of his a portion of his ownership of the property. I mean, I'm not saying that we would be talking about the same magnitude of problem, but that's not this case. I mean, this case is he can't live in his home, and that is unquestionably impairing his right to property. I would like, if there are no other questions at this point, to save the remainder from a rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Singleton. Ms. Adams.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paula Adams on behalf of the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office and on behalf of the Green Township Law Director Frank Heil. I will be sharing my time with the Attorney General's office today. As the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office and the Green Township Law Director are certainly in agreement that this matter involves a very narrow issue, and that with regard to the retroactive analysis. With regard to the first step of the retroactive analysis, we have indicated three separate clear indicators that the statute is to apply retroactively. The first being is that which the Second District held, and that is looking at the language of the residency restriction. And as the Chief Justice Moyer has pointed out, the has been convicted of, has pleaded guilty to, pleads guilty to language using the past and present tenses.
Well, but that could also be a reference to when the statute's effective, that within that period of time, that then it begins. Why shouldn't we? We have a body of law that's well established that tells us and others when a statute is retroactive. When the General Assembly knows how to say it, they do it. Sometimes they don't. Here they did not. This is a little ambiguous. It seems to me, well, why should we not just stick with our law and say this doesn't meet it?
And that would bring us to the second indicator, and that was the indicator of retroactive intent that the First District relied on, and that is the entire statutory scheme of Revised Code Chapter 2950 is a unique statutory scheme. When it was amended in 1997, that was the first time, even though we had registration laws in effect since 1963, that was the very first amendment that included retroactive language to Revised Code Chapter 2950. And the entire section builds upon one subsection builds on the other.
What specific language are you referring to that is retroactive at that point in time?
I think the four specific indicators that were discussed by this court in Cook, and its very first decision regarding Revised Code Chapter 2950. And I think to support that, whenever this statutory scheme has been amended subsequent to 1997, it has always been quite clear when they want it to have a prospective application. And three examples of that are on Senate Bill 3 for juveniles, for applying the registration and notification aspect to juveniles. It was clear that is only to apply prospectively. In Senate Bill 175 for the sexually violent predator specification, if there had been an acquittal of that specification, if you had a specification and you lost the specification, you weren't able to pursue the way the language read. You weren't able to pursue that person to register as a sexual predator. That law was changed. It was amended by Senate Bill 175, and that was to have a prospective application only, very clear. And most telling is Senate Bill 5, this very, the very bill that enacted the residency restriction also created the child victim-oriented offenses. And the General Assembly was very clear that aspect was to have a prospective application. So the state has been in the position that this statutory scheme, its entirety, the very nature of it is retroactive, because
your logic, it is, unless they specifically say this criminal statute is prospective in application, that by implication, everything else is to be retroactive?
Not quite. Number one, it's not.
That seemed to be what you were saying to us.
And I know that, again, this is the unique aspect of of the entire statutory compilation. And the fact that each subsection builds on the other, that if a person now has a duty to register, which no one has argued that Mr. Porter does not have the duty to register, now we're going to, in addition to the registration, have a residency restriction. And again, it's not a criminal matter. That's obviously, this has been decided many times that this is a civil aspect.
Well, counsel, isn't the distinction, at least that the first district makes here, is that this is remedial. We're not looking at punitive or a measure of retribution here. We're looking at a remedial statute. And as such, the prohibition against retroactivity is not automatic. And you look to the purpose of this remedial statute, and that remedial statute is based on, you know, the evidence that's out there is the recidivism potential likelihood of sexually oriented offenders. And
yes.
So to keep those individuals at a distance from potential victims is the intent here.
Correct.
It's a corrective, remedial, non-punitive. Isn't that where your analysis has to stand?
Yes, definitely. And I think that clearly the and with regard to the second step of the retroactive analysis with the substantive versus remedial, certainly the fact that it's been deemed that a certain distance of a residence between a school by the General Assembly is not imposes a safety problem. And this is in line with the legislative intent of 295002, that entire statutory scheme that's set out. And this is just an addition to the registration, the notification requirements. So therefore, that is surely supportive of the remedial aspect.
Ms. Adams, can you address our decision in Concilio?
Yes. I think that Concilio, that the statute involved in Concilio can be distinguished from our statute. Number one, the language initially involved in Concilio only used the present tense. And then I think one of the main distinguishing points is that when that statute was subsequently amended, the General Assembly specifically said, we intend this statute to apply retroactively, and they changed the language to the same language that's now used with this has pleaded guilty to, or has been convicted of, is convicted of. So I certainly think that that makes it distinguishable here.
I'd like to hear, I think you were about to talk about why is this not affecting a substantive right? I mean, the right to own property in this country is a fundamental right, and that means enjoy it, not just own it, but enjoy it. And as Mr. Singleton says, his client had a vested right. They'd lived in the property for a number of years, and now the state says, well, but you have to move. Doesn't that affect a substantive right?
Well, Mr. Porter indicates that it's a substantive right because he had a vested right to reside in the property. And when we talk about and his reliance upon Norwood v. Horney is not quite in line because, again, as was pointed out by the first district, Norwood v. Horney involved a total divestiture of the property rights. The entire bundle of sticks was taken away. And I don't know that these sticks come in different sizes.
Well,
certainly the right to reside.
If you're deprived of the right to live in your property, that's a pretty big stick, isn't it?
And again,
the whole bundle, to most people, it'd be the whole bundle.
It quite possibly, but while property rights are quite revered in our society, they are also highly regulated. And that's what we argue, and this goes to the remedial aspect of the statute that Justice O'Connor brought up, that there are laws too numerous to count that regulate these property rights. And just a few examples, you know, that I provided were the zoning laws with square footage requirements, the sewer systems, another the nuisance abatement statute.
Well, nuisance, course, nuisance because you're affecting someone else's enjoyment of their property. I mean, that's, but as Mr. Singleton said, those sewer rights and zoning, they don't quite equal removing someone from their house, do they?
Well, there are scenarios certainly where if there's not a sewer or a septic system that's deemed healthy, that could impair a person's right to actually reside in the property. But what we have here is really making the jump that, or the direct connection that use and enjoyment of property includes the unrestricted right to reside on that property. And I don't, and I think that's the, that was the finding by the Second District, and that's where we're in disagreement. And I don't think that's what's established here. It's just a restriction on his ownership. It's not taking it away entirely. Therefore, even if this were a vested right, the state still feels that the residency restriction. Well,
how far can the legislature go with this?
In a
few communities, one in the Columbus area, as I recall, a councilman proposed. They pass an ordinance saying if you're a sexual offender or whatever category they specified, you can't live here, period.
Well, and I think we can also look to other states and what they have done. And Ohio is somewhat unique in that
Could the legislature go that far? You can't live in Ohio?
I don't think that would necessarily be deemed a reasonable exercise of dealing with this issue.
So when do we get to reasonable out of all of this?
Okay. For the reasonable expectation or exercise of police power, that we have to bear a real and substantial relationship to the general welfare of the public. And I think that in Costin versus Porter, Judge Beckwith indicated that the safety of children is promoted when sex offenders are prohibited from living near schools. And that safety is furthered by denying sex offenders of a convenient safe haven near schools. So the distance here has clearly been drawn out at 1,000 feet.
Amicus brief, as you know, from some law enforcement authorities and others who work with children who have been molested, and they don't like this law either. They don't think it's helpful.
Well, they don't like the Iowa compilation, and again the distance, and that involves different dynamics between a different state. The geographic location. I see that I'm almost out of time, and I certainly want to allow Mr. Carney time.
The table here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adams. Mr. Carney.
Why don't you answer that question about a very unique coalition of groups that defend children, the law enforcement, are all arguing that these restrictions do not bear rational purpose and are not helpful, and there's no evidence whatsoever that they have prohibited a single sex offense. How do you deal with that in terms of whether you want to call it remedial or otherwise?
They should call their legislators in Iowa and the ones in Ohio as well if they like.
Yeah, but they're elected, so they're looking at votes. They're not looking at the reality sometimes.
The answer to the policy questions are several. First, that is for the legislature. Second, there is no rational basis component to remedial or substantive. I'll get to the vested right thing if I may, but I want to note that if someone wants to bring an equal protection claim or a due process claim, is there a substantive due process problem at some point pushing everyone out of the state? There might be. And that's one of the two key points here. We agree with Mr. Singleton that this is a narrow claim under retroactivity. So concerns about takings or the bundle of property rights can be brought as a takings claim. Complaints about rational basis can be brought that way. But although we need not defend the rational basis here, the legislature could have been perfectly reasonable in thinking a couple of things. First, we already have all these other laws to protect students from teachers by having background checks, soccer coaches, all those. A lot of these are acquaintances. That's one of the criticisms of these laws. But that doesn't mean we don't piece by piece adopt certain laws to take care of acquaintances and other laws to worry about strangers. And in particular, 1,000 feet is the narrow distance that a child often walks home. So the legislature could have thought, yes, what we're doing is preventing these strangers from becoming acquaintances by standing raking your yard every day and saying, hi, Johnny, how was the math test, till you become the acquaintance who then becomes the abuser. Because children are taught to worry about strangers, but when you see someone every day and you get to know them, they're not a stranger, they're a neighbor. So the danger of, you know, coming into house for cookies, those sorts of things could have been what the legislature had in mind. But all that's in front of us, I notice my red light is on, so I'll try to be very quick. The issue here is that he has two distinct retroactivity claims, and you have to separate them. You can't just bundle them all in together. One is retroactivity relative to an old conviction. The other is relative to owning the house, and those are distinct because he's focused now on the house one. In the first district, the focus was on the conviction. And as to living in the house, the answer is not is only is this a form of allowable retroactivity, but that is not truly retroactive at all. This court in Personal Service Insurance wrote about a contract that had already been in effect, a new law came along, and the court said, no, wait a minute, all we're saying is start following the law tomorrow. Even if it affects your expectancy interest in that contract, we're not attaching a new liability, we're not changing the interest rate of his home purchase, we're not changing anything. We do this every day.
A contract expectation is not a fundamental right under the Constitution, and property ownership is.
Correct, but when we come along and produce new rules for environmental changes where you can't do this anymore, we come along and outlaw a product. No more widgets in Ohio. You might have just spent $1 million on a widget factory.
Why is he not being deprived of the fundamental right to own and enjoy property?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First, you don't even reach that analysis unless you find it's retroactive.
Right, and let's assume it's retroactive.
Okay. If it is, the legislature here is acting remedially in several ways. First, they're not taking away his ownership, and if use is such a big part of the bundle, that can and should be brought as a freestanding takings claim.
With the law, and when we talk about fundamental right to own property, often it's connected with right to own and enjoy property.
Secondly, in terms of whether it's nuisance law, which may take away a business's right to operate its business, or if you're an owner-operator, you may not be able to live there anymore. But this court has never said the right to live wherever you want. If we were to take a whole area and change it to zoning, there are cases where this state has always, as a matter of policy, allowed in nonconforming uses and grandfathered them in, but they're not a fundamental right to keep living where you live. And even so, it's remedial here because the purpose isn't to punish him. It's not to hurt him. The purpose is to protect the children who live nearby. Again, that 1,000 feet walking
home
from school
is... But that's where the facts, I think. You mentioned all this amicus brief and so forth don't make a difference. But they do. If that's the argument, it's to protect children. Abundance of evidence that it doesn't do that.
But under this court's remedial versus substantive, the question is, did the legislature mean to do it for a remedial purpose? Whether it works or not and effectiveness, if we were to start challenging every law on effectiveness, there are all sorts of professors and social scientists who would argue over all sorts of environmental regulation, economic regulation, even criminal laws to say, do they work or not? If we want the court to review everything on whether it works, the question is, did they have a legitimate, rational purpose in wanting to try this? And if it saves at least some children, again, we have some laws that get at the teachers by doing background checks. All those laws came in with a prospective effect, but existing teachers were all of a sudden maybe harmed because you can't be a soccer coach anymore. You can't do this. As all these laws came online, which this court noted in Cook, if you applied retroactivity in that sense, you would not be able to bring a new law saying if you're an offender, you can't take this job or that job. And your right to a job is a pretty important right.
Counsel, you've commented on what the legislature was thinking. Is there any evidence that as they enacted this and then the subsequent additions to it that they did any look at concentric circles overlay in Cincinnati or in Greenville or anywhere else to see what the end result of that was in terms of where people who have this kind of a record can live?
Your Honor, I'll try not to get too deep because I'm in double overtime, but since you asked, there's... If someone brings a rational basis challenge,
I realize we don't have that case here.
If we don't have that record, we'd be able to build that record better if someone brought a proper rational basis.
I'm asking you if you know when they were determining the rationality of this, whether they took a look at that.
There is nothing in the record in that, in the legislative record that I'm aware of, but again, this wasn't brought up under that kind of challenge. But there are in other cases, which is why the court can and review other challenges cases. On the narrow retroactivity, the court should find it's not retroactive at all, and if so, it's acceptably so.
Let me quickly ask you to address Concilio for me, because I'm still concerned about what we've said there as it applies here.
First, Your Honor, I note that Concilio was a plurality opinion because Justice Cupp joined in only.
We were all together on that, side.
So some of the reasoning in there is only a plurality, but what it said there was specifically focusing on the conviction language and how the later, newer legislation there showed that the legislature hadn't gotten the trick right the first time around. Here we don't have that, and here we also have the unique factor that when the legislature was writing this, they were writing it as one more remedy as part of a broader 2950 scheme. When this court has already upheld the broad scheme as acceptably remedial in State versus Cook, when the legislature tweaks pieces of it, it shouldn't have to go in just when it adds a part E to A, B, C, and D. It shouldn't have to go in the same way and say, oh, and we mean this to be remedial, and we mean this, and this, and this, because it's all part of a whole. And by saying in here, unless you're registration exempt, they were tying it to a registration system that this court had already blessed as remedial, so they didn't sense the same need. And as to the home, because as we argue, it's not even retroactive at all, they have no need to state their intent when they're not being retroactive.
Although in Cook, we looked at a remedial situation that was strictly talking about classification, didn't add all of these additional, what seemed to be punitive, additions to someone who has been convicted in the past. As Mr. Singleton said, this is an as-applied to his client for what has already occurred. He has no objection to what's going to occur in the future.
Well, that's where I think we need to separate the claim about old conviction versus old homeownership, because as to the conviction, what the court said in State versus Cook is in the alternative, it not only had language about being acceptably remedial, but it said you don't even have an expectancy interest. It quoted the earlier Matz case that it's not even retroactive because you don't have an expectance of finality the way you do about a civil transaction when you commit a felony, and that you can't expect, and the court specifically mentioned the teacher hiring rule, saying when you commit a felony, you can't have an expectation that new different burdens, not just changes in duration or changes in registration type, but that new burdens might not come along. You don't have a finality interest in your felony other than what's protected independently by ex post facto, and as they admit in their reply brief, that's not here. The court can await that in an ex post facto case.
Thank you, Mr. Singleton, we've given the appellees substantial more time than 15 minutes. Take 2 minutes.
Thank you. First, Matz doesn't apply to this case. Matz was a case where you had a felon who was actually applying for crime victims funds, to which he had no vested right. Here, Mr. Porter has a vested right in his home for the reasons we argued earlier. Second, the government has essentially tried to turn revised code 1.48 on its head. What it's doing is saying this is a complicated statute, and because it's complicated and hard to figure out, maybe the government gets the benefit of the doubt here. That is never what this court has said. In fact, in Concilio, this court said that the Constitution requires the General Assembly to write statutes in such a way that people of common intelligence may understand what conduct is required. This statute doesn't do it. It's got to expressly say it's retroactive. The residency portion is ambiguous for the reasons I mentioned earlier, and that's why it can't apply. With regard to whether this statute is remedial or substantive, the question is not what the purpose of the law is. The starting in our case, because there's a vested right involved, the question is his right being impaired, a vested right being impaired? Because if a vested right is being impaired, the statute is substantive and is not remedial. That's the issue here. And Mr. Porter has a vested right to live in his home. That is being impaired when he's being booted out of his home. And so therefore, for that reason, regardless of why the legislature is doing this,
Counsel, would you then equate what's happening here with, for example, an eminent domain action that would not necessarily focus on a piece of property and have that included in the taking as proposed by the municipality or the state, but because the use and enjoyment of that property is so impaired by the state's action that the property owner can no longer live in it, use it for its intended purpose, and then force the state to assume it through an eminent domain and compensate him for his loss. Do you see any parallels there?
Well, I mean, this is the state hasn't appropriated any funds to compensate Mr. Porter or any other individuals.
I understand that. I'm talking about the deprivation of the use and enjoyment. Because
sure,
the argument
sure.
here is that, well, he can't live there, but that's okay because he can still own it. So he hasn't been deprived of a fundamental right, and that is to own his property. You're making the argument that if he can't live there, what good is it to own the property? Well, the argument could be made that his wife and children can live there.
Well, perhaps, but they're split apart, they're not living together. I mean, all of that stuff goes to the question of how important this right to reside in this home is. It's crucial, use and enjoyment is fundamental, and for all the reasons that I've mentioned, I'd ask the court to reverse the First District Court of Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Singleton. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshall, please adjourn court.
All rise.